this progressive, or some would call like democratic socialist wing of the Democratic Party. Uh-huh. I see it as a concerted effort to try to bring young people back into the Democratic Party because they have lost so much support right. because of Palestine. Because young people saw the Democratic Party carry out a Holocaust for 2 years, live streamed before our own eyes. No wonder people aren't coming out and weren't voting for Kamala Harris. And I think the Democrats realize that, and they realize they need younger, more progressive people who will say Free Palestine as a slogan to nice. Try to get people back into voting them and working in the party. But these people are not anti-Zionist. They're not anti-imperialist. They constantly defend Israel's right to exist. They constantly condemn the Palestinian resistance and the entire axis of resistance. They constantly promote, you know, regime change in sanctions against Iran. And so I think while it's positive to heighten the contradictions within within Congress, within the Democratic Party, right. within the U.S. government, electing these politicians is not a means to an end. And we have to be very, very careful with, you know, how working within these institutions might force us to compromise our principles. And so that's why I'm very openly critical of them.
Right, I see. And do you believe progressive candidates can still drive meaningful change within the system?
I think at the local level, that argument could be made. But I think, as I just argued, you know, I think fundamentally...
Kind of got my answer.
Yeah, it's... I see it as, you know, a part of, like, the counterinsurgency. Yeah. And I think when we have these huge ruptures and shifts of consciousness, like yes. after the Al-Aqsa flood, there was a huge burst of, you know, anti-imperialist consciousness in the United States. And I think one of the responses by the Zionists, by the imperialists, by the ruling class is to try to capture that energy and to funnel it into something that is fundamentally not challenging or threatening to U.S. empire. And so they would much rather have us be working on a campaign than, say, doing direct action against a weapons company.
Carla Walsh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Of course. And thank you for being with us on another soap. Thank you so much and goodbye until next time.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Greetings, everyone. This is Iran Radio, broadcasting from the bustling capital of Tehran. We are ready to share more programs for the next hour. Let's check out the next lineup. Our next program is Dialogue. This program offers a unique look at the most important conversations and dialogues between Shia infallible imams and their followers, questioners, and leaders of different Islamic faith and sects on various religious topics, doctrines, and also political, social, and cultural issues. Then we have Israel Watch. This program offers a critical look at Zionist media narratives and their views on West Asia. Hosted from Beirut, an expert guest joins for engaging discussions, challenging biased reports, and shedding light on Israel's actions in occupied Palestine. Next up, Ulema's Speech shares scholarly wisdom. Following that, we have Round the World with Reporters. Stay with us for the next program, Dialogue.
we have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today, we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses. And his eminence also had a positive and active share in the establishment of human culture and civilization. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, an individual who was divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah, was known to have improved the general public lives of the people and the Muslims, and he was an individual, a divinely appointed Imam, a man from the household of the Holy Prophet, who enhanced human thoughts and discovered many of the secrets of this universe. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So there are some beautiful statements and really interesting statements that have been made by Mansur Dawaniqi, who was the second Abbasid ruler. Now, what's really interesting is that many times in the conversations or the statements between Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and Mansur Dawaniqi, we find that this Abbasid ruler, he praised the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, what's really intriguing about this is that Mansur Dawaniqi was one of the most violent enemies of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And of course, it is at the hands of Mansur Dawaniqi that the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam as-Sadiq alayhi salam, was martyred. He was poisoned and then he was martyred. But we find that no matter how great the enmity and hatred and animosity of the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam becomes or reaches, that they are still forced to admit the excellencies of the divinely appointed Imams alayhim as-salam. And we find this with all of the divinely appointed Imams alayhim as-salam, that the rulers who wanted to kill and murder these Imams alayhim as-salam, these rulers and these murderers really of the infallible and immaculate divinely appointed Imams alayhim as-salam, they always praised them in one place or the other. Now, sometimes it was sincere praise because they had no option, because truth is truth, and, you know, eventually you cannot hide the truth.
But many times it was just for show, you know, to make the people think that, you know, they have nothing to do with the murder of the imams. So anyways, in one instance, Mansur Dawaniqi, he says to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, "We are still benefiting from your ocean and visiting you," meaning ocean of, I guess, wisdom and knowledge. And then he says, "It is you who restore light to the blind, and it is you who lights up the gloom. Therefore, we are circumambulating, we are doing the tawaf of your holy places and your endless oceans." In another place, Mansur Dawaniqi says that Ja'far ibn Muhammad was one of those about whom Allah the Almighty has said, "Then we have given the book for inheritance to such of our servants as we have chosen." And this is a verse of the Holy Quran in chapter 35, verse number 32. In another place, Mansur Dawaniqi says, "Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was one of those whom Allah chose and who hurried towards performing good deeds." And the last thing, when Mansur Dawaniqi was talking to somebody else about the excellencies of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Mansur said to him, "What really suffocates me is that Ja'far ibn Muhammad is the most knowledgeable in his time. Even the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt were forced to admit and prove the excellencies of the infallible and immaculate Imams alayhi salam." This is Dialogue Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio, our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now let's listen to Sayyid Muhammad Jawad Al-Ghazwini.
There was a man who had passed away. Very, very decent man in one of the communities overseas. During his fatha, his funeral, a person came, nobody knew him. And he was crying like he had lost his own father. The people, the family were puzzled. "Why are you crying like that? What do you know about him? We don't even know you. We've never seen you." He said, "I have a story with this deceased, this marhum. I have a story with him. One day he was in the masjid praying, and as he was praying, I noticed that he had a very expensive ring. Maybe because he had done wudu and he was waiting for hands to dry, or for whatever reason, he put his ring on the carpet as he was praying." He says, that person says, that "I have a habit of stealing valuable items. And I'm very good at it. I'm skilled at it." You know, some people, when they pick your pocket, you don't even notice it. He was one of those people. He says, "I go and stealthily, discreetly, without him noticing, I take the ring." And then he's like, I'm on the side. I'm making myself like I'm some wali min awliya Allah, praying my salah. He says, when he finished his salah, the guy was smart. When he finished his salah, he called me. He's like, "Come." He's like, "Oh no, I got caught." He noticed. He's like, "I tried to deny it, apologize. I was thinking of a strategy, an exit strategy." He told me, "Look, I know you took my ring. And maybe you're in need. I don't want the ring back. I don't want to take you to the police. But here's my business card." I told him, "Your business card? Why are you giving me your business card?" He says, "Because the next thing you're going to do, you're going to take this ring to a jewelry shop to sell it and make some good money. The jewelry shop owner, when he looks at the ring, he will know you stole it, because this ring doesn't match how you look." I'm just telling you, it doesn't match your appearance. And he's going to call the cops on you. If he doubts you, here's my business card. Tell them I got this ring from this person. The man says, "I went to the jewelry shop to sell it. The minute he looked at it, he told me, 'Look, I know this ring is not yours.'" And he wanted to call the cops on me. I took out the business card. He called the man. He verified it with him. He He said, I'm crying like someone who lost his father. In my life, I haven't seen someone like him. I don't know him. He doesn't know me. But that moment changed my life. After that day, I repented to Allah. I changed my entire path. One small incident like that can change an entire human being. This is the inspiration of Al-Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. And this is a beautiful lesson, beautiful teaching that we learned from him.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
You raise your tired hands toward the sky, and the dark night lights up as you praise God. Your tears rain on your hijab and this cold air is filled with the fragrance of jasmine flower. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes, and heal the scars of our city with your sense of heaven. Oh, Father, you do, and you give him your necklace and the only food in your home. You talk to God until the rising of the sun, and you forget yourself while praying for everyone. Oh.
thank you for joining us. Hebrew media highlighted several issues, including confrontations that took place in the Syrian town of Beit Jinn between local residents and occupation forces. The issue of resistance fighters in the Rafah tunnels and the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. We will discuss these topics and more with Mr. Ridwan Rizk, political analyst, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Mr. Ridwan.
Thank you.
The confrontations that erupted in the Syrian town of Beit Jinn in the Damascus countryside received significant attention in Hebrew media, which gave a detailed account of what took place. How would this incident affect the broader situation, including the talks that's being held between Netanyahu's administration and al-Julani regime?
Well, that proves that Julani does not control Syria and does not control the groups in Syria. And that's very obvious what's happened in Beit Jinn. That's an organization, jihadist organization or group, decided to confront the Israeli, operating in those villages among the Haramun.
Which jihadi organizations, Mr.
Well, some reports connecting this group with the Muslim Brotherhood organization, mm-hmm. and proves that some of the people there or the villages are not very welcoming with the the Israeli army to freely operate in those villages, arresting or killing some of the people who wants to fight.
But these incidents can affect the talks that are being held between the two sides?
No, I don't think so, because Julani brought to power to implement a certain agenda with the Israelis. And he announced very clearly that he will not allow any groups to operate against Israel or to threaten Israel in any way. So that means he will go along with the Israelis to prove that he can make a deal with the Israelis, that the Israelis will be freely operating along the borders with Syria, mm-hmm. With his permission or without his permission. But for his own sake, he is going to...
But al-Julani is supported by Turkey, and we all know Turkey's how Turkey views the Israelis. They do not like them at all.
Well, we can say that this is some kind of a struggle between Turkey and Israel, who is going to take over or to control Syria.
Yes.
So this proves that some of this understandable situation, because if the conflict of interest in Syria between Israel and Turkey, that might lead to some of what we have seen in Beit Jinn. So we might also see that Julani is a very squeezed in the corner, because he is going to prove that to the Americans that he is controlling Syria and he mm-hmm. can go for a deal. But at the same time, he cannot rule or stay in power without this direct support from Turkey.
Okay, but can we explain what happened as an anti-Israeli popular resistance that's being created in Syria?
Well, sooner or later, this resistance is going to be created and active, even among Druze or other outside Druze villages.
It's not developed yet with such an incident, you're saying?
It's on its way. I think it's under development, because things are not clear yet. But I think that formation of a resistance needs time and needs organizing. And especially in the area or in the region where the Israeli army is operating and or invading or taking off some of the Syrian villages or territories, so we might see in the future very similar or larger on a larger scale of resistance operation in Syria.
Okay, we're staying in Syria, where Israeli commentators called for taking more Syrian territory following the confrontations that took place in the town of Beit Jinn. Would it be in Israeli strategic long-term interest to actually expand its occupation in Syria?
Of course. The plan of Netanyahu of creating the greater Israel need to take over Syria. This is what he comes across the interest of Turkey in Syria, because also Syria wants to take, Turkey wants to take parts of Syria, especially Aleppo, and maybe control the whole country. And I believe that this operation, what's, you know, happened in Beijing, I think if I want to figure it out in a very deep way, that this is a message from Turkey to the Israelis to prove to them that they have power or influence on some groups, which, you know, can shake the just the situation.
Yes, but Israel obviously is creating a dilemma for itself by trying to expand inside Syria. I mean, Al-Julani is giving them the green light, whether for talks, whether for normalization. Why the fight?
Well, I think Julani is in a very ambiguous situation, because he does not control anything. And
even the report here highlighted that obviously the Israelis are aware of the areas that Al-Julani do not control, and they're saying that they should actually conquer it.
I don't believe at all on the situation, especially, you know, last night I had a meeting and I have received lots of information on this, you know, Syrian situation. I don't think that Julani has any power outside his presidential palace, and he does not control anything at all, because so many groups, especially the foreigners in among the
and that's why the Israelis do not want to have serious talks or normalization, or even open the way for a talk with Julani,
because they don't believe that he does not have any credibility and control of anything. So that's why they are going along with their plan, with or without his permission.
So they view him as a weak,
very weak. You know, they consider him nothing but a muppet in the hands of the Turks.
Even if they do that, why would they want to expand when they have the chance for a talk with the president, even if they view him as weak?
Well, he is going to, after all, he is going to join the normalization of the you know, treaties, and they will give full power or full advance of the Israeli army operating any time, anywhere in Syria, without his permission or without, you know, without his permission. So
they're not in need of it, you're saying?
They don't consider him as a credible president or control his own country, so to make a deal with him.
Okay, now let's take a listen to some of the comments on Israeli social media about the confrontations that took place in Syria.
Roy Kais. In the Syrian town of Beit Jinn, the Islamic Group organization is based. It is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in Lebanon and maintains close ties with Hezbollah and Hamas. Jude. If the Israeli army withdraws from Syria, it would allow greater spread of organizations such as Islamic Jihad. Intel Times. There is activity against Israeli forces in southern Syria that closely resembles the activity of groups that operated against U.S. forces in Iraq.
Moving to Lebanon, Hebrew Media revealed U.S. efforts to change the formula of the ceasefire agreement in Lebanon in a way that serves the continuation of the Israeli occupation in southern Lebanon while maintaining freedom to carry out aggression there at any moment. Do you anticipate that the Americans are formulating a certain kind of agreement or a change in the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon?
Well, what's the need for the change? Because the ceasefire agreement was very clear that to stop all military operation and reach a total ceasefire. But the Israelis committed to the agreements on implementing the ceasefire in Lebanon. They did not. So by changing the deal, what and where to they want to take the country? Because now we know that...
Maybe to give them a mandate to what they are doing. That's what the cause of the change in the formula.
Exactly. I believe that they are going to take a part or part of the south in Lebanon now to be under a full occupation of the Israeli army. So the Israeli army now freely operating with the mechanism watching and doing nothing at all, not even objecting or stopping the Israelis from reaching some of the towns. So and they were putting the blame on the Lebanese army, which is, you know, Lebanese army denied all accusations coming from Israel and proved, and he published a statement saying or showing the whole world what he did during the last year on operating south of Litani River. So,
but could such changes to the ceasefire agreement be understood as an alternative to a full-scale war? Can it be understood like that? Because here the commentator said that what is the need of going into a full-scale war when the Americans among the ceasefire included rights to Israel to move around? But in your perspective, could such changes to the ceasefire agreement be understood as an alternative to a large-scale war in Lebanon?
Well, well, during to my knowledge, was the conflict between the defense minister and the commander of the Israeli army. I don't believe that the Israeli army is capable now to launch a full-scale war.
Why?
Major war, because after almost 3 years in Gaza and Lebanon of fighting and operating, I think that the Israelis are not prepared for to launch a major war. I think it's
so. How would they function? Continue assassinations.
Continuation of, you know, if we take this, some of the numbers that casualties and martyrs in Lebanon reach about 1,500 people were killed or injured by Israeli operation without launching a major war during the last year. So this continuation of this policy might fulfill the interest of the Israelis on the ground without, endangering their
operation. So you don't view any change in the formula of the ceasefire agreement?
No, I don't think so.
We remain in Lebanon, where one Israeli commentator believed that after the assassination of martyr Tabtaba'i in Beirut's southern suburbs, the Israeli entity must strive to strike the leadership of Hezbollah in its entity. Do you think that Israel may embark on an intensified and assassination war with Lebanon?
Well, it's a continued since the October 27th of October, since last year, this policy did not stop and it's continuing, and that proves that the assassination of Mr. Martyr Tabtaba'i, that the Israelis are going along with this policy. And we might see that some of the politicians even in Hezbollah, not only the military section, might be targeted by the Israelis. We might see some other targets like MP members of Hezbollah will be the next target of Israel.
Why? So, what would that accomplish?
They think that they want to eliminate all the leaders of Hezbollah, military or politically. And they want to assassinate every person who might be the leader or the next leader to be appointed on Hezbollah. So this policy...
To place more pressure on Hezbollah?
Well, they think they can eliminate the total elimination of Hezbollah even from the political life in Lebanon. So this comes to a situation where Hezbollah at one point of a time might be urged or needed to retaliate or launch a major attack against the Israeli army.
Okay, if they move forward with the analysis that you're sharing, what would be the ramifications of that?
Well, that might lead to a major war then, because now the war is not being ignited because Hezbollah is not responding or is not retaliating in any way at all. So to avoid any provocations of the Israeli army, and does not want to be dragged into a major war due to the consequences and the situation changed in Lebanon and Syria also, because that affected the situation. And with this full green light from the Americans for the Israelis to do whatever they want to do on the ground or in the region, so Hezbollah might be able to delay the major war. But at one point of a time, if Hezbollah launch a major attack against the Israeli army in the south, that might lead the whole area to a major war.
Okay. And to the occupied West Bank, where Israeli aggression continues against camps and towns in the north. One Knesset member pointed out that relying on coordination with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is no longer effective, calling for cooperation with it to be halted. Mr. Redouan, do you believe that the aggression in the West Bank will end the security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and the occupation?
Well, it's a very funny talk, because the agreement between the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis, did it prove that it can change the situation in the West Bank? The plan, or you know, the Israeli plan in the West Bank is they want to evacuate or to do to displace the Palestinians or to kick them out of the West Bank to Jordan or Lebanon, but they want to have the West Bank empty or total evacuation for the Palestinians.
Okay, this continuous aggression against the West Bank, would it actually end the security coordination?
It's leading to kick out the Palestinians out of the West Bank and to build more settlements, because we know that at the time that Oslo was signed, there were about 100,000 settlers in the West Bank. Now it's 800,000 settlers since the 1992. So this agreement did not change the situation and did not twist the Israeli plan from expanding its territories to be, you know, to control or to take over to a full occupation of the West Bank with no Palestinians in.
Where do you think that the occupation will go and its continued aggression in the West Bank?
Well, I think this is preparing,
as part of the annexation plan.
From my point of view, that will accelerate the ending or the destruction of Israel, for the country, or the whole country will be falling down, because this expansion cannot be controlled by 6-7 million people. The territory is full of people, full of.
But they have the blessings of the American administration.
Well, the American administration does not change anything on the fact that people in the region now on the resistance move. So they cannot accept or will be able to accept the existence of Israel on others' territories, and especially the whole Palestine is occupied by the Israelis. So the Americans, if they want to solve the situation, they must accept that this state cannot be continued. And what we are seeing in the America, by changing the American mind or look at the whole situation, is might be very bright, because the Americans are not, I'm talking about the American people here, about the public opinion, are not any longer buying the story of the Israelis.
Okay, Mr. Ridwan Rizk, thank you very much for joining this episode. You're a political analyst.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant practice.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. We're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned. Indeed, we revealed it during the night of decree. In this surah, Laylatul Qadr, or the night of decree, is mentioned five times. There are five instances. Inna anzalnahu fi laylatul qadr. Ayah number 1. Wa ma adraka ma laylatul qadr. Ayah number 2. Laylatul qadr khayrun min alf shahr. Ayah 3. تنزل الملائكة والروح فيها بإذن ربهم من كل أمر. Ayah number 4. سلام هي حتى مطلع الفجر. Here is a pronoun referring back to ليلة القدر here.
این پنج تا آیه داره. تو پنج تا بحثش به قدره.
So there are five mentions related to Qadr. In our narrations, it is stated that the night of decree or Qadr is in the last 10 nights of Ramadan, on the 19th, 21st, and 23rd nights. Some narrations say these are stages, meaning on the 19th night, the fabric is cut. On the 21st night, it is basted and pinned. And on the 23rd night, the final sewing is done. It is phase by phase, like a building where one stage is bricklaying, then plastering, and finally painting. Some narrations explain it this way. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
یوسف جلالی تهران
روباشاوید گازا
جروم هیوز بروسلز
سعید پورزا لندن
راشان سگلم استانبول
سعید امین عالمی کابل
شهان بات ایندین ادمنستریت کشمیر
Around the world with reporters.
Venezuela has been the subject of intense media attention in recent months as the United States doubles down on its pressure aimed at overthrowing the government in Caracas. In the eastern state of Anzoátegui, an assembly of local leadership meets as part of a process to fortify the United Socialist Party, the PSUV, from the grassroots level.
What the Venezuelans want is peace, prosperity, and we have our own democratic system. We have elections. We are even electing at this moment communities and popular power all over the country.
Venezuela held another election on Sunday to vote on local projects at the communal level, which will be funded by the state. And while the spectacle continues on social media, daily routines seem unaffected.
Things are happening. People are going to the beaches. People are going to party. People are working, are studying, but we are also getting ready for any scenario. If the imperialism of the USA tries to attack Venezuela, we'll know how to answer, and we will prevail. Venezuelans, the only thing we want is to be respected, and for the world and for the great powers to respect our sovereignty, to respect our people and our self-determination.
Throughout the country, daily life continues for Venezuelans against the backdrop of the incessant campaign of aggression leveled by the United States against the country as the massive military buildup escalates in the Caribbean Sea.
Governor of Anzoátegui, Luis José Mercado, says while calm reigns, Venezuelans are prepared to defend their nation.
In our state of Anzoátegui, which is part of the Caribbean coastal region of our country, we have entered a period of permanent mobilization. What we have done for these past 3 months or more is carry out intense activity involving military, police, and popular mobilizations. Each of our 205 community circuits has an organization with militia units that have been mobilizing, holding night marches and meetings, conducting training exercises, and carrying out military-style preparations. In Venezuela, the majority of us, the women and men of this nation, are absolutely determined to preserve our independence and our sovereignty.
Venezuela is a country at peace, advancing in its various transformative projects, strengthening its economy in the face of the economic blockade and guarding its sovereignty. Camila Escalante, Anzoátegui.
The Italian capital, Rome, has hosted an event dubbed A Journey into Persian Cuisine, organized by the Iranian Institute of Culture in collaboration with the Italian National Hoteliers Association Federalberghi and the Betoia Hotel Group. The initiative aimed at presenting Iran's rich gastronomic heritage and diverse regional influences. Italy, like Iran, places utmost importance on culinary traditions.
Iranian food is one of the most important food systems in the world, in diversity and health. And one of the most important our obligation is exchange these food systems and gastronomy between Italy and Iran.
Gastronomy embodies the culture of hospitality and acceptance. Everybody knows how culinary traditions are important for Italy. The same applies to Iran, where I have been kindly welcomed a few years ago.
This journey into Persian cuisine is an initiative aimed at promoting intercultural dialogue through the universal language of food. Participants say it offers them an experience that engages all the senses and opens a window onto an ancient civilization. From savory stews like Rome Sabzi and Reime Bademjoun to aromatic rice dishes such as chelo kebab kubide, participants had the opportunity to discover a wide range of Iranian flavors, textures, and aromas.
The food that I like the most is the biryani labu. I love beetroot and yogurt mixed together. It tasted delicious.
The food we had today was excellent. I felt welcome and as if I was in my own home.
Now I have a crazy urge to visit Iran. Flavors were amazing. The food wasn't even too spicy. What I loved the most was the contrast of flavors in every bite.
It's called gastrodiplomacy, and it is a form of cultural diplomacy that uses food as a tool to stimulate intercultural dialogue and strengthen international relations. During the event, speakers all agreed, through the universal language of food, it is possible to better understand the other. Max Civili, Rome.
The Venezuelan embassy in Tehran marking more than a century of Bolivarian military aviation, a force that Caracas describes as revolutionary, people-centered, and central to defending the nation's independence. This year's celebration also commemorates the 33rd year since the November 1992 civic military uprising, an event that Venezuelans regard as the rebirth of their modern air force and a turning point in their political history.
We mark 105 years of our Bolivarian military aviation, and since President Chavez established our defense doctrine in 1999, we remain fully prepared to protect the country. As you know, since August, the United States has issued threats. And for more than 17 weeks, their warships have stayed deployed. President Maduro has ordered military drills. And at the same time, we face pressure on many fronts.
More than 30 military attachés from foreign embassies in Tehran attended the ceremony, an expression of solidarity amid ongoing external pressures on Venezuela. During the opening remarks, the Venezuelan ambassador addressed what he called continuous threats and coercive measures from the United States, and attempts to undermine Venezuelan sovereignty under the pretext of fighting narco-trafficking.
We are fully prepared under the current circumstances. All our armed forces stand ready and follow the commander-in-chief, our president. All military commanders maintain unity and discipline, and the solidarity we see today in Venezuela is exemplary. We are prepared to defend our country and the peace of our republic.
Iranian officials at the event praise Venezuela's resilience and its alignment with Tehran's own stance of strategic independence.
I can say that Iran and Venezuela's relations are strategic because of the high-level officials of Iran, I mean the president of the Venezuela and our supreme leader, they have this very high-level will to have strategic relationships. It's because of our, our beliefs about the resistance and resilience of against imperialists and arrogant people and arrogant governments.
For Caracas, the 105th year milestone is more than an anniversary. It is a message of continuity, resistance, and commitment to their national identity.
Iran and Venezuela may be oceans apart, but they are close in their shared fight against imperialism. And on this anniversary, Venezuela is also vowing to keep alive Simon Bolivar's legacy. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Tunisia made the headlines on Wednesday after President Qais Saied summoned the European Union's ambassador to lodge an official protest against what he called the failure to respect diplomatic rules. A statement from the presidency provided no details on the alleged breach in protocol by the European Union envoy, but referred to the use of practices outside diplomatic customs, a reference to his recent meeting with Nordin Tabubi, the leader of the North African country's main trade union. On Monday, Giuseppe Peroni, while meeting with Tabubi, commended the role of the Tunisian General Labor Union, UGTT, who is responsible called for the country's enhanced cooperation with the European Union. However, the revelation sparked criticism with the Tunisian authorities, calling it an interference in internal affairs. We believe that the President's invitation to the European Union ambassador and his request to respect diplomatic rules and international agreement reflects a commitment to national sovereignty, a principle that was violated in the past 10 years. These comes as Tunisia faces a long political crisis with the reduced role of parties and organizations. That has also increased the state's sensitivity toward any external actions. Also, the UGTT was part of the 2050 National Dialogue Accord and seen as an influential counterweight to Saeed since he took the helm of power back in 2021, which the opposition described as a coup. The UGTT's ability to take on a larger political and union role depends on its strength and influence. Since 2011, it has been a key player in both politics and labor issues and an active partner in every government. President Saeed has stressed that national sovereignty is a red line. Any political decision is in the hands of the government, and that relation with Europeans must be based on mutual respect without pressure. Many observers say Tunisia is open to cooperation with the European Union, but remains firm in protecting its political independence. However, the latest draw amid internal tensions and the challenges, the future of relations between Tunis and Brussels remain uncertain.
The European Union has been Tunisia's largest trading partner and TLA for decades. The two remains at odds over a number of issues, including migration and human rights since Saeed came to power. The summoning of the European Union ambassador over the alleged interference in domestic affairs could sour the relation even further. Iskandar Nawar, Tunisia.
First came the media campaign, then the pressure from conservative politicians, threats against members and damage to their property. Now the Austrian state prepares terror charges against one of the most established anti-racist and anti-colonial organizations in the country, Daral Chanoub. Among the accused is their current chairperson.
The situation was similar like the house raids against our association Daral Chanoub in February. The house raids were supported by heavy force through the special unit Vega, and they came into my apartment and they confiscated laptops, telephones, documents from the association, and also private books, for example a book from the 1980s in German language from Rassan Kanafani.
Following the raids, the activist lost his job and is now facing several charges for his political support of Palestine and anti-colonial struggle in the global south.
The state prosecutor accused us of membership of a criminal organization, membership of terrorist organizations, and also the we are people who force others to violent acts and terrorist acts.
The association had to close their premises due to the growing legal expenses. The activists face imprisonment of up to 10 years if charged. The Austrian government launched its crackdown on pro-Palestine protests and activists after October 7 in 2023. It imposed a ban on the first rally that was held after this date, but activists went ahead and held the rally, which resulted in the arrest of hundreds of them. Now, 2 years